today in the 3 o'clock hour, a reunion of sorts from as part of our week-long multimedia special report, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer. That, of course, is the federal government, and a lot of the ways that the buying is done, the policy is set by the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. Two former leaders of that office are my guests in the 3 o'clock hour today. In studio with me here in Washington is Al Berman, president of Jefferson Consulting Group. Al, it's great to see you as always.
Nice seeing you, Francis.
And joining us by phone from Harvard University, professor of public management at the Kennedy School there, is Steve Kelman. Steve, always good to talk to you as well, my friend.
The same, and nice to talk with Al always. So this is going to be hopefully some fun.
I hope so, too, and I hope we learn something through the process. Now, what we're doing, gentlemen, is each day of this week, as part of this series Inside the World's Biggest Buyer, we're focusing on a different aspect of acquisition and procurement. Today, it's purchasing from the agency perspective. Tomorrow, the people who do the work will take a look at the acquisition workforce. Wednesday, it's what are the standards and who is accountable. Thursday, what happens when the system breaks down. And Friday, acquisition from the industry perspective. And I thought what we might do to kind of start off my program's coverage for this series is use this hour and go through each of these and look at them from your perspectives as leaders of OFPP. And, of course, we'll start with what we're focused on today, and that is purchasing from the agency perspective. In your view, each of you, and I'll start with you, Steve, is it your view that acquisition purchasing is getting easier or harder or staying the same from the agency perspective since you've been in at OFPP?
Well, I think it's probably getting somewhat harder because many of the things that the government is buying are becoming more complex, and particularly there's been a move from buying products to buying services, and services are often harder to buy for a bunch of reasons.
Are the agencies getting better, do you think, at trying to sort out one proposal versus another when it comes to those services? That's a complaint that I have heard from industry. I seem to be hearing it less.
Al, do you have a view on that? I mean, you're actually sort of an industry now. I feel slightly incompetent to comment on it.
I think anyone that calls you incompetent is really speaking out of hand.
I'd agree with that.
I'd call myself incompetent.
Steve, you know, my view, Steve, is I agree with you. We see even in the defense world, 57% of what defense is buying is services these days. So many of the rules and procedures that have been established over the years have been set up to buy things, to buy products, and to try to make them work effectively in this new environment is tough. It's not the same sort of thing. And one of the things that's creating a bit of an issue or a problem is that in some respects, people are looking at techniques for buying complex services that really aren't that appropriate. And maybe they're doing that because they'd like to try to simplify the process, or they feel that people don't have the right skill sets to do it. But I've heard a number of complaints from industry, particularly in the complex service arena, on agencies using something called low-price, technically acceptable kinds of approaches, where, in effect, you're saying you're going to go ahead and use a very simplified process and get kind of the basics for something that tends to be a very complicated, complex set of things, set of services to acquire.
I mean, sometimes, I guess, and here talking specifically about services, we, the government, make it almost excessively complex for ourselves. For example, in buying new IT systems, we have traditionally gone this very grand design, try to specify everything in advance, do these enormous projects, which are harder to manage, harder to specify, harder to do, rather than dividing them up into chunks, having shorter lead times, small capabilities, and so forth. In some senses, we're making it harder for ourselves. This administration, but this actually went back, of course, Al, you served under the first President Bush. I think the idea of modular contracting started being around the end of your period, as OFPP administrator. It certainly was around during mine. The Obama administration is making a big push on this in connection with the 25-point IT plan to try to move buying IT services and new and systems development into a simpler, more smaller chunks, not trying to do everything, you know, in advance kind of approach. So I think sometimes we make it more complicated for us. Similarly, another thing that we both worked on, you know, you in the Bush administration, I in the Clinton administration, performance-based service contracting, which doesn't seem to be getting as much attention now, unfortunately, as it did maybe 10 years ago. Again, I think a lot of times agencies are specifying very complex, you know, do's and don'ts for what the contractor is supposed to do rather than what may sometimes actually be easier or less complex, which is specifying a performance result.
Al, is it reasonable to think that we can simplify a process for buying something like some of the services we're talking about that is very complicated?
I think you can. And in many ways, some of the developments, some of the things that Steve has been talking about have really tried to move in that direction. When you're trying to identify, for example, an outcome. I mean, what performance-based contracting was about was basically this: identify the outcomes and give people some flexibility to try to figure out how best to get there. But the purpose for doing that was to invite lots of companies who do different things into the marketplace and take advantage of innovation and take advantage of quality. And you can come up with a relatively simple kind of procurement request, a request for a proposal, when you're defining the outcomes but allowing a lot of flexibility in how people can meet them.
Steve, how do we get away from some of these initiatives that seem to come back over and over again? Coming back implies that they were here and went away. How do we get away from them, and how do we avoid that cycle by keeping in place some of these concepts that seem to be popular and seem to work but that seem to fade after a while?
Well, I think sometimes they fade, sometimes they don't. I think the hope is, and it's one of the reasons I'm so happy, and I'm sure Al feels the same way, that the two of us are appearing together on this show and in violent agreement with each other on pretty much everything. He, an OFPP administrator in a Republican administration, I, an OFPP administrator in a Democratic administration. You want to try to have continuity because as much as you can, and keep better management of the procurement system out of partisan politics as much as you can, because these initiatives, if it's just an initiative, it's forgotten in 6 months, it's never going to accomplish anything. You really literally need years to try to make these things part of the system. And I hope Al remembers, I suspect he remembers, the first day when we were transitioning, and it was his last day in the office, my first day in the office, and I had sort of a meeting with him, and I hope you remember this, Al. I said, Al, tell me, what are the two or three of your priorities that are the most important to you? I can't absolutely promise, but I'm going to do my best, if you tell me what they are, to continue with them. Because I think as best as we can, we need to try to continue these improvement priorities across administrations and across party lines. I think that, unfortunately, in both the second Bush administration and to some extent in the Obama administration, procurement has become more of a partisan issue for various reasons. And I think that is devastating, both because it makes it more difficult to continue initiatives long enough so that they're not initiatives, but they become actually part of improving management practices, and also because when the elephants are fighting, I hear, I don't mean the elephants like elephants and donkeys. I mean the big guys are fighting the smaller creatures, namely the sort of the frontline contracting folks are just terrified, and they run for, I'm mixing metaphors here, I apologize, they run for the hills, or maybe run for cover, doesn't mix metaphors quite as badly. I think when the procurement environment becomes very involved in partisan politics, it makes the rank and file contracting professionals scared and timid.
I certainly agree with that, Steve. And one of the nice things that has happened is Joe Jordan actually made it through a confirmation process and did it very successfully. And it was kind of nice to see that this was a job that wasn't held up, that people recognized the importance of the job. And as Steve said, this is really good government stuff. And most of the kinds of things that we're dealing with are things to try to help make that process work more effectively and really should be outside of that partisanship area.
Al Berman's president of Jefferson Consulting Group. That's the voice that you're hearing here in the studio. On the phone with me is Steve Kelman, professor of public management at Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and both former OFPP administrators. With me today on In Depth with Francis Rose as part of our week-long multimedia special report, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer. All of our resources are loaded up for you now at federalnewsradio.com. When we come back, Steve Kelman and Al Berman talking about the workforce, the people who do the work, next on In Depth with Francis Rose.
This is John Gilroy from Federal Tech Talk. You know, I've done over 260 interviews here on Federal News Radio, but many listeners still ask, what does your company do, John? My company is called Armature. For the past decade, we have worked with organizations that have programs for conformity assessment, accreditation, standards, and policy management. Is your agency responsible for conformity assessment? If so, then please visit our website, armaturecorp.com. We can help.
Pooling together really rewards. Van pools have now been added to the popular Pool Rewards program. If you currently drive alone to work and can carpool at least 2 days a week or form a new van pool, you may qualify for a cash incentive or reduced commuting costs. Visit commuterconnections.org. Click on Pool Rewards to find out more. Need to find others to rideshare with? Commuter Connections provides free ride matching services too. Pool Rewards. It pays to rideshare. Some restrictions apply. Visit commuterconnections.org today to get started. Federal cloud computing has never been easier. Amazon Web Services GovCloud is now on GSA's IT-70 schedule exclusively through Aquilent. Eliminate security concerns, simplify procurement, and ease implementation. A community cloud created just for the government makes it secure. GSA IT-70 makes it simple. Only Aquilent makes it easy. Go to buygovcloud.com now for Amazon Web Services GovCloud and Aquilent's end-to-end federal cloud services. That's buygovcloud.com.
Accenture, high performance delivered. It's how we help clients take on their most complex challenges. We helped process $650 billion in benefit payments for U.S. federal organizations. And we helped eliminate $348 million in U.S. federal fleet, inventory, and freight costs. With unmatched capabilities across defense, public safety, and civilian, Accenture consistently delivers results at speed. Accenture, high performance delivered. To learn more, visit Accenture.com/federal.
What is the strategic direction for the United States Coast Guard? How will steadying the service make the U.S. Coast Guard ready for today and prepared for tomorrow? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and many others with Admiral Robert Papp, Commandant of the United States Coast Guard. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Visit myvillagegreen.com, listen to past shows, and discover other healthy living resources.
Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Garden of Life and Boron.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Tuesday's Federal Drive. National Defense University is helping federal acquisition managers across the government update their skills. Two faculty members join us as part of our special series, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer, plus computational toxicology. It's a mouthful, but it's changing things at the EPA. Those stories and more tomorrow morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today, as part of our week-long multimedia special report, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer, Steve Kelman, professor of public management at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and Al Berman, president of Jefferson Consulting Group. And what they have in common, of course, is that they both have served as administrator of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. One of the things that people in government that pay a lot of attention to stuff have been focused on lately, gentlemen, is the workforce, the acquisition workforce, the people who are working with the end users at agencies to actually get the stuff that the agencies need. What trends are you seeing? We'll start with you on this one, Al. What trends are you seeing in the kinds of people who are coming in to do this work, the kinds of people who are staying around to do the work, and the ability of the government to attract the right people to do both of those things?
Well, one good thing about the trend is that I think there's a recognition both in the administration and in Congress that these people are critical to making that process work effectively. People are what it's all about. And so there's been a lot of support to try to beef up those numbers. And we are seeing the numbers go up. One of the challenges that agencies have is, particularly as you get into the higher levels, the more senior people, the more senior journeymen positions as well, is there's a fixed number of these folks. And so they tend to move from one agency to another, but there's not a whole big increase in terms of people at that level. And so many agencies these days are looking to get people right out of college, bring them in as interns, looking for people that have the right kinds of business backgrounds and skills, and providing them training and mentoring and coaching and those sorts of things, and using academies that they put together, you know, the VA, the Federal Acquisition Institute, the Defense Acquisition University, to try to bring the skill sets to these folks. So that is a bit of a challenge. You do have a younger workforce. They tend to be asked to move up pretty fast in terms of dealing with very complicated kinds of processes and systems.
Steve, do we ask them to maybe move up too quickly relative to their abilities to execute? This is not something that you can just do for a couple of months and get it right. You've told me in the past, Al's told me in the past, it's 5 to 7 years for somebody to be in government doing this stuff to really have a good sense of what they're doing.
You know, I'd rather lean on the side of putting people in a little over their heads than not challenging them enough from a perspective of developing them and also keeping them. Because I think, I mean, I've asked a lot of sort of the young people coming into the workforce, which situation would you rather be in if you had a choice? One where you're, I'm just oversimplifying the way I ask the question, but sort of basically one where you're not challenged enough or one where you're challenged too much. And 80% usually say they'd rather be in a situation where they're challenged too much. So from a management perspective, I actually don't think, I think we should be moving people up and particularly giving people more difficult tasks sooner rather than later. I'm worried we're not doing it fast enough. However, having said what I just said, from a political perspective and given the bad political consequences that can happen to an agency if they make a mistake, I understand why agencies are as cautious as they are about letting people who don't have a lot of experience, make mistakes. They don't want them to make mistakes. So I'm inclined to think sort of the happy medium is getting the new people in on as team members in a more complex task, but where they're not leading the activity, but sort of learning and part of a team where there are more experience, sort of basically teaming more experience with less experienced people.
Al, one of the things that I would see coming out of the scenario that you set up, which I believe is accurate based on what I'm hearing from both sides of the industry government equation, is poaching. We're seeing agencies going after other agencies' workforces. We're seeing them going after contractors' workforces. We're seeing the contractors going after the agencies' workforces. And it's causing maybe more fluidity than is good for the system. Or does that fluidity not really matter as long as the people that are churning are knowledgeable, skillful people?
Well, I'm not sure how much it matters, but that's clearly what is going on, that if you find somebody who's got some good skill sets, an agency will look to bring that person on board, and they'll give them a bonus or they'll figure out a way to get them a promotion. And so you do have that kind of pressure on the system. Again, though, since the numbers are limited, you still are going to be having to look at lower-graded, newer folks to try to beef up those numbers overall.
Steve, what grows that pool? What, in addition to what Al mentioned with the acquisition institutes and academies that are across government, is there something that agencies can do to help beef up at least the potential candidates for the positions, or is that kind of beyond their reach?
No, I think a lot of these, the new people, many of them are going to have to come in as entry-level positions, and they're just going to, some mixture of training and learning on the job. I think that agencies should be looking for, particularly in this tough job market, which makes federal employment somewhat more attractive, undergraduate business majors, MBAs. I mean, that should be the group among which, in my view, we should be recruiting, because they're people who have the kind of business training that is a good prerequisite for being a good contracting professional. And they should be looking for opportunities for more, let me call it, mission-oriented training of the kind that the VA Acquisition Institute provides, rather than simply training and learning the FAR. Now, they do have to learn the FAR, but I think that they need to learn the mission, and they need to learn get opportunities for creativity and so forth. So I think, number one, I think the agency should be recruiting undergraduate business majors and MBAs. Number two, they should be looking for training opportunities that are as mission-focused as possible in the spirit of the VA Acquisition Academy. And third, as I indicated before, they should be looking for opportunities to give these new recruits meaningful and challenging work in teams or however sooner rather than later, or else I think a lot of them are going to get bored and leave. I mean, they're going to become part of this churn and, go to, the government trains them, and then they leave and go to work for the private sector.
Steve, you mentioned the FAR, and we've talked a little bit about maybe the tendency of some folks to play it safe, and that's what I want to talk about next when we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The standards and who's accountable to those standards is where we'll go in this conversation with Al Berman and Steve Kelman next on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, MetLife, and Grantham University. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
How can we determine which armed aerial scout helicopter is best for the U.S. warfighter? By proving it in competition. EADS North America is ready to prove that our AAS-72X is superior to any other armed aerial scout helicopter out there. So let the competition begin. Saying you're the best isn't good enough for our warfighters. You need to prove it. EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Symantec and Carahsoft present Protecting and Securing Your Data in a Virtual World, Data Center Consolidation and Optimization. The widespread adoption of virtualization and reduced budgets are driving tremendous changes in the federal IT landscape. In the face of all this change, one thing remains constant: the need to protect and restore your agency's data at a moment's notice, whether it resides on a physical or virtual server. How are agencies addressing this challenge? What technologies and best practices are available? Does your agency have any best practices you would like to share on this topic? Tune in on June 12th on WFED, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, for a panel discussion of industry and government experts at 12 noon for protecting and securing your data in a virtual world. Brought to you by Symantec and Carahsoft. For more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword virtual, or thevirtualbackupplan.com.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning, NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
Mouths and Knees. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Bacteria might link the mouth and the knee. Researchers looked at data on 36 patients with gum disease and arthritis of the knee. In about 15%, the researchers found that the fluid that lubricates the knee had bacteria with the same DNA as the mouth plaque. Dr. Nabil Basada of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, suspects gum inflammation let the bacteria get into the bloodstream and wind up in the knee, where he thinks it could cause problems for arthritis patients. So he says,
the easiest way is to minimize that risk by treating gum disease, or even better, preventing gum disease.
The study in the Journal of Clinical Rheumatology was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
The CIO Council's recently released digital government strategy goes beyond mobile technology to rethink the way federal agencies manage information and interact with citizens. The shared platform approach not only addresses data, application, and device management, but also how to mitigate the threat of security breaches. Join FC of Bethesda on June 20th at the Bethesda North Marriott for a discussion about how agencies transform this policy into action. Register at fcofbethesda.org/junebreakfast.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests, as we talk about acquisition as part of our week-long multimedia special report, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer, my guests today, Al Berman, president of Jefferson Consulting Group, and Steve Kelman, professor of public management at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and of course, both of them OFPP administrators in the past. And one of the issues that I thought was particularly interesting, each of you has mentioned at various times throughout the conversation today, the federal acquisition regulations, the FAR. I looked just a minute ago, I opened up the PDF file from acquisition.gov, and the FAR is 2,011 pages long, the current edition. The people that work with the regulations included therein every day are expected to obviously go by the book. The regulations are there for a reason. But I wrote up this really quick inventory of people who are watching you do what you do, and I want you, each of you gentlemen, to chime in if there's somebody that I missed. Other people at the agencies. Agency Inspectors General, the Government Accountability Office is watching acquisitions, members of Congress and congressional committees, and other contractors who may be concerned that an acquisition is done incorrectly are watching. Those are five sets of eyeballs.
The media.
And the courts, the Court of Claims.
So seven sets of eyeballs, potentially, on every acquisition. And I guess when we step back and think about the standards and accountability, it's not hard to understand why people get a little bit nervous about making sure that they go absolutely by the book and not taking any risks. And yet, Steve, you've written from time to time, and Al, you and I have talked in the past about the need potentially to take more risks and, yes, fail early and fail fast, but to be able to take risks with seven different kinds of eyeballs looking at you is not a very comfortable thing to do, is it, Al?
It would almost make you want to stay home in the morning, wouldn't it? It is definitely a challenge, but one of the things that you try to do is you try to give people the grounding and the background and the skill set so that as they get along in years and understand this field, they have some flexibility in doing the right thing. I think one of the challenges you also run into is when you get all of these kinds of rules, and then when you have from directives coming down that more or less constrain people even further, then it becomes awfully hard to get innovative approaches, to get new things, and that's a major issue, I think.
Steve, I'm going by memory, but I seem to recall that you were a fan of Dan Gordon's MythBusters, and I imagine MythBusters 2 as well. Do I have that right?
You do have it right.
And are you optimistic that, again, we talked about transitions, and you mentioned the transition that you engaged in with Al. Are you confident that as time goes by, the effort that Dan made to try to enhance communication and to encourage acquisition officers at agencies, that if it's not in the FAR, you have that flexibility? Are you optimistic that that can continue and that that can eventually become standard operating procedure?
Well, I mean, you know, in some sense, what Dan was trying to do was return to where we had already been about 15 years earlier during the 90s. So he was trying to sort of get us back to where we had gotten and then move, you know, moved away from it. I think that these pressures from, you know, the overseers that often tend to make people very, very cautious and just sort of stick what's in the book. They're, for better or worse, always going to be there. I guess I would say two things. One is that I continue to be pleasantly surprised and very happy how many frontline contracting folks and their managers have enough commitment to the mission of contracting, which is to support agency missions, that they're willing, they're mission oriented enough so they are willing to try sometimes to go out on a limb, to try to think for themselves a little bit, and not just to be destroyed by the system. There's a lot in the oversight system that can easily beat somebody down. So the first observation is that there's a surprising number of people in the system who are committed enough and idealistic enough that they're actually trying to accomplish something and not just letting the system beat them down. Second is, and I've written about this as well, we need to be a little bit careful about feds not being too afraid of their own shadows. I mean, yes, it is true that there's some risk that you make an innocent or inadvertent mistake and through a series of bad luck or things beyond your control, you get into real trouble for something that was not really particularly wrong or bad or whatever. Can that happen? Yes, it can happen. It does happen. But it doesn't happen that much. I mean, generally, I think that if a contracting official behaves in an ethical way, does the right thing, in a common sense way, and I'm not talking about sort of looking at every paragraph of the rule, I'm talking about in a common sense way, you know, acts in a sensible way, the strong odds are they are not going to get in trouble. And I do think that parts of the federal workforce really do tend to get afraid of their own shadow. You hear all these stories about, if people are going to be fired or killed or whatever. I mean, you know, as we know from other contexts, it is not easy to fire a federal employee. Now, again, I'm not saying these things never happen or whatever, but I guess at the end of the day, I do think, and I'm curious actually to get Al's reaction to this, that for all of the talk about, 2,000 pages of rules and violating any of them, can lead to the most dire of consequences, I think that if people behave in a way showing common sense, ethics, and integrity, that you don't need to read any rules to understand, somewhere between usually and almost always, you're going to be fine.
He parsed that very carefully.
Yes, listening to each one of those phrases to see where I would come in. But, Steve, I agree with you completely. I think that there are a lot of people who try to do the right thing. And, if you look at some data on the process, because people do complain about the system and people doing bad things and that sort of thing, or people not doing these procurements, well, even if you take something like a protest, which is some indication of somebody feeling that somehow they've been treated unfairly or wrongly or the system hasn't treated them well, you have hundreds of thousands of contract actions in a year. And what's the number of protests that go up to the main forum, the GAO? About 2,200 protests a year, maybe 70 to the Court of Claims. And so when you look at those numbers, that's a very small number in terms of how some indicator anyway of how is the system working and how well is the system working. So I'd agree with Steve. On the other hand, having gone through the process, and we both did back in the 90s, trying to encourage people to get rid of regulations, people move toward commercial approaches to buying things, I did still find a lot of reticence. It definitely helped to have somebody up on the Hill say it's okay to use your discretion to do these kinds of things or to give a little bit of cover to the process.
Al Berman and Steve Kelman are my guests on Federal News Radio 1500 today, part of our week-long multimedia special report, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer, talking in this segment about accountability on the government side. Sometimes it's the contracting side where accountability is required, and we'll talk about that and the controversy surrounding suspensions and debarments when we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The year was 1941. America was about to go to war. Rosie the Riveter had not yet become an icon. But one October morning, Marie Kalk and 18 other women walked into the new Glenn L. Martin airplane plant in Omaha looking for jobs. At about the same time, Bernice Olsen went to work at the Lockheed factory in Burbank. None of them thought they were going to make history, but they did, along with nearly a half million other women who joined the war effort. Because they were doing more than building workhorse aircraft like the B-26 bomber and the B-38 Lightning. By answering their nation's call, Marie, Bernice, and the others blazed a trail that their daughters and granddaughters would one day follow, all the way to the top. Their story is our story. See it and others unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Visit myvillagegreen.com, listen to past shows, and discover other healthy living resources.
Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Megafood and Jarrow Formulas.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Stephen Van Roekel, the Federal Chief Information Officer.
One of the things we're happy to report on this 18-month anniversary is we're now at about $100 million a year in savings because of the cloud email services. And I think that's just a tip of the iceberg. I think as we go through other programs like PortfolioStat and look at others, I think there's a lot of potential out there to drive a lot of savings here.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Our week-long multimedia special report, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer, includes today's conversation on In Depth with Francis Rose with former OFPP administrators Al Berman and Steve Kelman. Al in the studio with me here in Washington, and Steve joining us by phone from his office at Harvard University. We talked in the last segment about accountability on the government side. Sometimes accountability is necessary on the contractor side. Suspension and debarment receiving a lot of attention lately because of some new regulations, policies that are coming out of Congress and just the general political environment where it seems to me, at least, and maybe you gentlemen can correct me if I'm wrong. You've been doing this, obviously, for a little bit longer than me. It seems to me that in the past, I'd say 2 years or so, the calls on both sides of the aisle in Congress for suspensions and debarments seems to have gotten much louder and much more common. Is that a correct observation on my part, Steve, or am I seeing something that maybe isn't there?
My instinct is that this is sort of it's again another one of these cyclical phenomena. I think certainly when I was around, I think it was around to some extent during the Bush administration. My instinct, and Al, tell me if you agree on this. I don't really, I hate to say that I don't follow this hugely closely, but I think it's definitely around now. I think it's been around a fair amount in the past as well. I'm not sure if I see a sort of a secular trend. Aldi, what's your take on that?
Yeah, Steve, I do think that there's perhaps been a little more interest and a little more focus on it, more of a notion that we need to penalize these guys that are doing it. And, of course, when you're looking at suspension and debarment, what you really are looking to do, what an agency is looking to do, is to protect itself from a bad a bad operator. And so it's not perceived as a penalty per se. It's perceived as a way to protect the government from making sure that the government can get good results. And many agencies, as they should, have in place due process approaches so that when something occurs, there is an ability to at least allow some kind of redress on the part of the contractor when something's happened where maybe people perceive it one way. It's not necessarily something that was done intentionally, but I do think, Steve, that there's more focus on it today, perhaps, than there has been.
Is there a right amount of either threats or actual suspensions of debarment, Steve, or is it really just eye of the beholder and depends on what's happening in each individual situation?
Again, it's a little bit hard for me to say. I'm repeating myself here. I don't really follow this hugely closely. I sort of more focus a little bit on the government and how this looks from the buyer's perspective. One observation that's sometimes been made, and I think there's something to it, is that the government may be more hesitant about suspending or debarring a very large contractor than a smaller one, both because the government may be more dependent on getting services from them, and also because they may be have more political clout and so forth. I guess from a philosophical perspective, suspension of debarment is obviously designed to deal with the really very bad performer or the sort of an egregious and particularly ethical violation and so forth. I would much rather have more attention, but of course this doesn't get the attention because it's not as sexy from the Hill's perspective, to something that we started in the 90s and I think has worked a little bit but not as successfully as it should have, using past performance in the source selection process. That's a way rather than these sort of dramatic, you suspend, debar, this sort of, small number and get big headlines and stuff like that, which again is why the political folks love it. Instead, is a way to punish poorly performing contracts by not giving them new contracts, but also it's not just the stick that, again, a lot of the political people like, but it's also the carrot that if you're an outstanding performer, you're going to be more likely to get contracts.
Let me give you an analogy that I was thinking of, Al, as I was preparing to talk to you gentlemen over the weekend. I used to work for a guy a long time ago in the years before there were HR departments, and every once in a while he would fire somebody. And one time I asked him, such and such was a pretty good guy. What was that all about? And he said, every once in a while, you fire somebody just to keep everybody else honest. A terrible management philosophy. But it sounds to me, some of the dialogue that's coming from Congress, it sounds like that's almost where they're headed. Let's drop one every once in a while, encouraging agencies to really use this authority a lot more heavily than they are. And that's almost what it feels like coming from some of these folks.
It's one way to get your attention, I guess. that's true. But you probably shouldn't be using a shotgun on something where unless you can really demonstrate that there's fraud, there's been abuses, that it's appropriate to make sure that company is not doing business with the government. So I don't think that's probably the best approach.
But it seems like that's where they want to go.
I think people see it as a clear penalty, as a way to try to address, wrongdoing.
Steve, as you look at this and you try, as you mentioned, you're looking at it from a different perspective now, but how do you think this rhetoric might wind up being dialed back? You mentioned this is kind of a cyclical thing. A lot of these things are cyclical. Any thoughts about what will drive this cycle back to where it was, where this is not something that we hear about and talk about as much?
Well, I'm guessing that as long as the country I think the procurement system a little bit is hostage to the general political environment in the country, and it's hard. if the partisanship in national politics is really at a sort of a hyperbolic level, it's hard to avoid that splashing over into the procurement system. So probably the way that has the most potential, and by the way, also the way that I think would help the country more generally, not just in the procurement system, is if the voices more in the middle, in both parties, can start finding a way to work with each other. I mean, the procurement reform efforts of the 1990s really politically came about as an alliance between moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans against the fringes in both parties. The fringes in both parties did not like the procurement reforms of the 90s. The procurement reforms of the 90s came about with the moderate voices in each party, working together. If that's not possible, it's hard to get this very, I mean, the sort of the denouncing and this sort of the headline gathering or headline seeking and finger pointing and terrible contractors, terrible bureaucrats, all that kind of stuff really grows out of a hypercharged partisan environment. And is part of that. And I think the only way to reduce some of that name calling, whether it be anti-contractor name calling or anti-Fed name calling, because both of them are out there, is if the general rhetoric level in society as a whole goes down a little bit. That would be good for society as a whole, by the way, not just for the procurement system.
Steve Kelman's a professor of public management at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Al Berman is president of Jefferson Consulting, and both of them with me today on Federal News Radio 1500 AM as part of our week-long multimedia special report, Inside the World's Biggest Buyer. We'll wrap up in a moment and talk about acquisition from the industry perspective on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Be right back.
Recently, United Healthcare was selected to serve the families in the TRICARE West region, and we want those who we will serve to know more about us. United Healthcare is part of a company of over 115,000 people, serving over 75 million Americans nationwide. Our people work hard to be a trusted healthcare partner for all of our members, and we're proud of our track record of quality service. The American Medical Association ranks us number one in claims processing accuracy among the seven leading commercial health insurers for 2011. J.D. Power & Associates names us number one in its employer satisfaction survey. And Fortune magazine has named us its most admired health insurer 2 years in a row. As provider for the members of TRICARE West, our people will work every day to put our unmatched provider network, industry-leading innovations, and passion for service to work for you. We are United Healthcare. And for us, the chance to help military families isn't just a job, it's an honor. United Healthcare.
At the Jeep brand, we've been on active duty for over 70 years, in conditions you can imagine and some you can't. And like our soldiers, we never shy away from a challenge. So we'd like to honor our armed forces' outstanding service during the Jeep military event. Get $500 military bonus cash toward a new 2012 Jeep vehicle. After so much time in service to others, we're giving our soldiers the recognition they deserve. Jeep.
Hurry into your local Jeep dealer or visit Jeep.com for the special military offer, along with other great incentives on the full line of legendary Jeep vehicles. Offer available to active military and military reserve, and to retired military and military reserve, with honorable discharge and 20 years of service within 6 months of discharge date on a retail purchase or lease. Excludes SRT models. See dealer for details. Jeep is a registered trademark of Chrysler Group, LLC.
This is John Gilroy from Federal Tech Talk. You know, I've done over 260 interviews here on Federal News Radio, but many listeners still ask, what does your company do, John? My company is called Armature. For the past decade, we have worked with organizations that have programs for conformity assessment, accreditation, standards, and policy management. Is your agency responsible for conformity assessment? If so, then please visit our website, armaturecorp.com. We can help.
Join the Northern Virginia chapter of AFSCEA for their annual Spring Mentor Protégé Night, Thursday, June 14th at Maggiano's in Tyson's Corner. If you're under 40, in the beginning or mid-level of your career, you won't want to miss this opportunity. The opportunity to connect with seasoned professionals who are happy to share their ideas, past experiences, and their advice. That's sure to help you reach your professional goals. For more information and to register, visit AFSCEANova.org.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose. My guests today, Al Berman and Steve Kelman, former OFPP administrators. Al, you're the one of my guests today that is now looking at this from the industry side. Steve's in academia. What are you seeing? What are maybe a couple of the key points in just the 2 minutes or so that we have left about the changes, the trends that you're seeing from industry's perspective? Is it getting easier or harder to do business with the government? Do companies still think the government is a good partner to work with? That kind of thing. What do you see?
You know, the main thing, Francis, I think, is to go back to the Dan Gordon Mythbusters business. I mean, one of the biggest problems that the government has is being able to accurately let people know what it is that they want or to find out what's out there in the marketplace. And the more that you can get a good conversation going and good communication and do it in a fair way, but allowing industry to better understand your needs and better understand how what you might be looking for, I think that serves both the government very well and industry very well also. So I'd say that probably more than anything, figuring out ways to keep that communications flow going and going smoothly is as important as any of the kinds of reforms we could be talking about.
Steve, we only have about 30 seconds left. Was there anything in the myth or that was not in the Mythbusters campaign that Dan designed that you would have liked to have seen in there that might have facilitated the conversation between industry and agencies?
It's a pretty good attack. I've got 10 seconds to answer that.
Steve, we have confidence.
It was a good memo, and like everything Dan did, just about it was on the mark. There's nothing I can think of that quickly that a big point that should have been there that wasn't.